I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Amit Goswami, and we're going to talk about segments from two of his new books. One is God is Not Dead, and the other is Creative Evolution. How are you, Dr. Goswami?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I have to confess something, though. I had your books read, and I had all my notes in the back of the book to ask you, and then I had a man that was my science advisor. He was another physicist that helped me prepare for some of my shows, and he died this week. So my book with all of my notes are among his possessions, and I haven't been able to get my book back with my notes. I'm going to have to kind of wing it, so please be patient with me.
Well, that is great news, because wing is the best way of doing an interview. You know that, Eva.
Yeah, but your books are so packed of information, I wish I had my notes, you know. You've got to help me here. All right, well, everybody knows who you are, so you don't have to really give an introduction. So why don't we just go ahead and dive into these books and let's talk about God is Not Dead first, because I think that's the first one, right?
Yes.
What is the focus of your book there?
Well, the focus, I think, is clear by the name of it. I think people have prematurely, people like Richard Dawkins, the great biologist, have prematurely declared that God is dead once again. You know, Nietzsche did that some time ago. This time it's again the same complaint about a Christian God, which is a very simplistic picture of a God sitting in heaven and doling out judgments on people when they die, and who goes to heaven, who goes to hell, that kind of thing. But what they miss is that it's a metaphor. What they're really saying is that there is an agency of another kind of causation in addition to the material interaction, which is one level of causation. So this one we call upward causation, because elementary particles makes atoms and makes molecules, makes cells, make brain, and all the way cause always rises upward. The other one we call downward causation in the religious traditions. But it's you have to look at the information that is being proposed. What is being proposed is that there is another source of causation. And quantum physics completely supports it, because in quantum physics, there is a need for another source of causation, because it is a fact that objects are possibilities, and there is no mathematics. Quantum physics clearly declares that there is no mathematical way of getting from possibilities into actual events. So how do possibilities become actual events then? It has to be a choice from a consciousness. So if you think of that way, the spiritual traditions are totally right in insisting all this millennia that there is, besides material level of causation, there is another source of causation.
Now, how does that consciousness decide? Is there free will?
Absolutely. Consciousness decides out of its total freedom. That is why we cannot predict it. That is why there is no mathematics. And that is what quantum physics is stubbornly declaring since 1925, that there is no mathematics for this decision, and therefore it is free. And therefore there exists another source of causation, and that total freedom, and that is not separate from us. It is a subtle level of our own consciousness, non-ordinary state of our own consciousness. And if we can access it, we are free. We are free to choose.
Okay, let me make sure, because I want people to understand that clearly. You're not saying that the human being has complete free will, but that consciousness has the complete free will, right?
Yes, I'm saying that if we can reach that non-ordinary state of our consciousness, that it's not our ordinary state of consciousness. In our ordinary state of consciousness, we have very limited choice based on our conditioning. All that is true. Although, even in our ego, we retain the freedom to say no to our conditioning. And then we become open to this non-ordinary or extraordinary consciousness, which sometimes is called super consciousness. And it is in that super conscious state that we have freedom to choose.
Okay, and that's the altered state of mind that someone reaches when they get where they can meditate and, obtain optimal meditation states?
Yes, meditation is a way of, meditation is just a way of practicing towards that state. Actually, this state is reached best by what I call the creative process, a process which involves both doing and being. In fact, alternative doing and being, I sometimes jokingly call it the doobie-doobie-doo process. And when we proceed with this alternative doing and being, this kind of practice, so being is meditation, doing is preparation, like we read up, we think about it actively, we do things, we listen to lectures, we go to the laboratory, prepare experiments, all of that is doing. But being is something of relaxing. We don't think about the problem. We don't do anything about the problem. We just sit. We sit and meditate. That is also important. This, if we do alternatively, doing and being, then what happens is a quantum leap. A sudden insight takes place. In that sudden insight, we see clearly that we can choose the creative insight, creative idea that will solve our problem, that will solve the predicament that we are in. And this is what freedom to choose is about. Freedom to choose is about taking the creative option, taking the new option that did not exist before, that I have not, the road I have not taken before.
What is the difference, or is there a distinction between conscious and unconscious?
Yes. In conscious awareness, the distinction is a little bit subtle. Because we use the word conscious in slightly different ways, because we also use the word conscious as the ground of being. Consciousness, we say, is the ground of being. In that ground of being, there is not necessarily awareness. When awareness appears, we say we are conscious. So we see there are these two connotations of the word consciousness, and that's what makes it a little confusing. So unconscious is when there is no conscious awareness, namely a subject-object split experience. When there is no experience, there is no separation between subject and object, then we are not conscious of it. That's what we call unconscious.
Okay.
And when there is subject-object split, there is conscious awareness. That's what we normally call conscious. Things get a little bit confusing because we also say that consciousness is the ground of being. Consciousness is everything. So, you know, this linguistic problem was started by Freud because, you know, to him, probably everything was not very clear. And so he called that unaware state as unconscious state.
Yeah, I think the linguistics is a big problem. I think I told you this a few years ago. You know, I've been doing these interviews and I ask, let's say I did 100 interviews and I ask 100 people, what is consciousness? I get 100 different answers.
Yes,
from the
do.
Scientists, you know, from Tiller and Radin and Wolf and you and John, and everybody has a different meaning exactly of what that thing is.
Yes.
So it's a problem. So
It is a huge problem. We haven't quite thrashed it out yet because right now we are struggling to let the scientists of the materialist ilk, at least for them to be patient about us and hear us out, you know, we are looking for that privilege. Since even that kind of dialogue has not happened, we had hardly any chance of thrashing out the linguistic differences among those of us who are trying to develop this new science within the primacy of consciousness. But at least there is some agreement now, I think, that there is consciousness is primary, that material level of metaphysics which says that matter is the only thing, that kind of metaphysics is not going to answer the deep questions of reality. I think this much people are more and more agreeing.
So when we talk about consciousness, the ground of all being, can you give us a clue? Is it a field? Is it a wave? Is it?
Well, it is everything there is. So this is why it's difficult to state it as a field. I think if you say consciousness is a field, then you are objectifying consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But consciousness is also the subject that experiences object. So I think the best thing is to, this is why I say consciousness is the ground of all being, both subjective being and objective being. It's the ground from which everything, both subject and object, emanates.
A lot of the scientists, when you ask them this question, I have gotten, they start referring about zero-point field. What's my understanding that the zero-point field is like a temperature or something? How do they relate this?
I think again there is a tendency for even the scientists to acknowledge that consciousness is the ground of being. There is a tendency to play it a little cool so that the materialist scientists don't get a downright refusal experience, you know, don't get jarred up too much. So they tend to objectify consciousness, call it a unified field, call it a zero-point field, call it an Akashic field. But all of this, as I said, does not satisfy me because, you know, consciousness is not an object. These things are sort of objectifying consciousness. Like, you know, in the olden days, like in the 80s, we used to say holographic consciousness. Again, it objectifies. It suggests that consciousness is a hologram. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is not a thing. That has to be clearly understood. And, you know, only philosopher David Chalmers, he has repeatedly made us conscious that, look, we have to deal with the fact that objects only produce objects. So if you give an objective description of consciousness, then sure, that is nice, because objects will produce objects, and you have an objective model that is acceptable to the materialist. But where is the subject? You are, unfortunately, faced with the problem that thwarts the materialist once again, because you are leaving the subject out. In order to include the subject, you've got to go beyond the objective language. And that is what I try to do by saying that consciousness is the ground of all being from which both subject and object arise.
So how does consciousness convey what it has? How does it convey its information to mind? And then my second question is, how would that convey its information to brain?
Okay, so brain arises in consciousness. So there is no conveying information because brain is not separate from consciousness. Instead, what happens in a perception, event of perception, is simply that event of perception, a stimulus is presented to the brain. Brain is also an object. So brain makes an image of that stimulus. This much is true. But the brain is very special. Because it is very special, I call it a tangled hierarchical, slightly complex concept, but I'll clarify it soon. Tangled hierarchical apparatus in which this transaction or transformation of possibility into actuality can take place in the proximity of the brain. Because that happens, consciousness identifies with the brain and becomes the subject. So brain and the stimulus, both are objects in consciousness, but because of the brain's special role that it has, it's a tangled hierarchy. Because of that, consciousness identifies with the brain and becomes the subject of the experience. So our experience is that we as the brain are experiencing the object that I am seeing.
Okay. Is mind, I understand big mind and little mind, but is mind separate, big mind separate from consciousness? And my next question is, how does little mind distinguish itself from big mind?
So then, in the brain, of course, every event of perception produces a memory. Little mind identifies with those memories. Whereas big mind, of course, is free of these memories. Big mind is where this choice from quantum possibilities take place. The big mind is where there is complete freedom. So the difference between big mind and little mind is that little mind is identifying with all the previous memories and therefore has lost some of the freedom because it's identifying with previous responses. Its tendency will always be to respond as it responded before to a stimulus, whereas in the big mind, we are always free to respond with total freedom, with creativity.
Where does little mind reside? I mean, what I'm wondering here is, you know, everybody has an aura around them. And I would presume that it's electromagnetic or some kind of field or energy. Is little mind contained within that?
Little mind is an identity of consciousness also. So think of it as identities of something that cannot be objectified. Only when it identifies, it becomes similar to an object. So we can say brain is making a representation of consciousness and becoming a little mind because it has identified with all the previous conditioning that is memorized in the brain. So in that way, brain has made a representation. You know, in a sense, this is why all spiritual traditions have words like God makes man in his own image.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When we say that, what we mean is that we are a representation of God. But we are a very limited representation when we are in our ego. So the spiritual traditions also tell us that, okay, rise beyond the ego, go into the freedom, because then our capacity for making a better representation becomes improved. And this is when we have somebody like Jesus who is saying that, well, I am the Holy Spirit and you can come only through me and all that stuff, which also becomes very confusing because we in the ordinary human being, we deify such people. But if everybody has the capacity, if only we are open to it.
Does quantum physics support that the quantum memory survives death? In other words, what's the support that we don't die or that we continue to exist after the body drops?
Exactly. So the big support for this comes from the idea that we have two kinds of memory. One kind of memory, of course, dies with the brain. No question. That is the content memory. You were born in so-and-so place, you were born with so-and-so parents, you were married with so-and-so person. These things are content of your life. These are memorized in the brain and dies with the brain. But in addition, the way you process things, what is called your character, your patterns of habit, the way you respond to a given situation, creative or conditioned, that kind of thing.
Hi, Eva.
Hi, Eva.
I think we have a caller. Hello?
Hi, Eva. It's Ernie.
Hello, Ernie. Sorry, Dr. Goswami, we have a caller here with this question. Do you mind taking it?
It's fine. Yes, I'm hearing it.
Hi, Doctor.
Ernie.
Good evening. And hello, Eva. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question regarding a topic you were on a few minutes back about you were talking about how conventional medicine, you touched on the subject of conventional medicine and their willingness or lack thereof to embrace some of the alternative methods or medicine that you know, we know exist. Do you see any movement yet in the raising of awareness?
Ooh, something's happening to the phone.
Yes, I hope it gets better. Yeah, oh, okay, it's now better.
Dear. Okay, sorry, we had some technical problems. Go ahead, please. Hello? Amit?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead and answer that question if you would.
Okay. The question of health, medicine, the way I see it, we are not even acknowledging alternative medicine in any which way of talking about medicine. And this is a tragedy. It's a travesty. Alternative medicine is well established. It has a theory. It has great amount of success through millennia of experience. And still, we are not using its efficacy in healing. For especially for chronic diseases, alternative medicine is effective, much, much more effective than conventional allopathic medicine, which really only cause eventually long-term harm. It cures the short-term symptoms, but in the process, produces side effects.
Hi, Eva.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Eva. I apologize. I guess I got dropped off.
I think you've got a problem with your line, Ernie.
Yeah, it was on my side. Yeah.
Okay.
I apologize.
So ask your question again, and I will.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. I was just asking you if you think that conventional medicine is opening up, if they're starting to embrace some of the alternative medicine methods, you can see, is evolving. And I just kind of wonder if you see any movement in conventional medicine towards embracing some of the alternative medicines.
I don't see much movement as a collective. I do see movement individual people of conventional medicine are paying attention, that is very true. But for example, in this healthcare debate that is taking place in Washington and all across the country today, which is very important for our future, for saving medicine as a healthcare system, there is virtually no acknowledgement that there is an entire system of medicine, alternative medicine, waiting for us to be acknowledged, which can bring healthcare way down and give us real preventive medicine, not this pseudo-preventive medicine that we can talk about within allopathic system. It's just a travesty that nobody is bringing this out, or people are bringing this out, people such as me or Eva or even alternative medicine doctors, but nobody is listening because AMA is much too powerful. They have all the ears of all the legislators and even the president. So, this is a very, very unfortunate situation.
So, Ernie, you might want to hang up. Your phone is terrible. It's making a terrible noise. Can you disconnect it, Don? Something's wrong. Oh, I'm sorry. We were having technical difficulties. So let's talk a minute. It's still bad. Are you there? Wow. I don't know what to say. I've never had that problem before. Let's talk a bit about evolutionary ethics. What is that, Amit? Hello?
Exactly what went wrong here, but one of the lines is bad, and now we can't reach anybody. So if you'll stick in there, we'll keep trying. Thanks.
Okay, Amit. Sorry, I think we've dealt with our technical difficulties now. I don't know what happened. So tell me, do you think is there any evidence that life continues after death? Any scientific evidence?
Very, very good scientific evidence now in many scores. First of all, of course, all these past life recollections that children basically have, and Ian Stevenson, the University of Virginia psychiatrist who just died, his lifelong research have totally established the validity of this recollection.
Now, can I ask a favor? We might need to put you on separate lines because even with the equalizers on, your volumes are so different that I'm going to just pull you off the air to the audience. We'll be right back, but hang in there. It's worth it, so just stick around.
Okay.
So we've had technical difficulties tonight, and we're trying to resolve it, and we're going to get Amit back on a different line. I don't know what's happened, but just be patient with this audience, please, and we'll get him back on the phone and see if we can't continue our discussion and get questions answered. So give us just a moment, and Amit will be back with us.
We got everybody. And to your audience, we do apologize. Actually, it's not really something we could do anything about here at the station, but we always love a good challenge. So, enjoy.
Okay, Amit, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, now, I'm sorry. I don't know what, I've never had this problem before. It's the strangest thing. I wonder if it's not my dead friend coming back trying to tell us something, you know? Because his consciousness was his wife. So how do we know that the children that we were just talking about in reincarnation aren't saying what they say due to some kind of conditioning?
Well, because they would recollect something, and Ian Stevenson would follow them up. And he has such a wonderful bunch of followed-up stories that just are totally convincing. For example, this girl in India started recollecting that she was born in this and this village and has been her past life, and the house, and she started describing things. And this is just a small girl in a small village who has never been into this other place, which is quite far away.
So Stevenson
takes this girl to the village of her description, and following her lead, they find the house, and then she starts recollecting further things. And then she says that there is a hidden place in the house where they will find some money. And indeed, lo and behold, they find the hidden place and they find the money, and money is old money. So there is just no doubt that this could not be concocted. So, and the girl has never been to this village or to that house. And there are so many stories of that kind.
Let me ask you this. Is it really past and future, or is it happening simultaneous in another dimension?
That, of course, is a question that we have to, we cannot really decide from this kind of data, because it could be a non-local experience coming across time. So to answer that question, what we do is that we look for other data of reincarnation. This is only one kind of data. But another kind of data is very important, which is that people have, there are two kinds of data there too. One is the phenomenon of geniuses. This has always been a tremendous problem. How some people, some child prodigies, develop special genius signs. You know, that's why they're called prodigies. Like Mozart, who became a, who started having the capacity of composing an entire symphony at the age of six. Or Ramanujan, that's an Indian mathematician who started summing infinite series, but there was not even any mathematician in his whole family. So where could he learn such characteristics? So the idea has to be that character inherited from past life. And this is where the theory, quantum theory that I have developed, comes in very handy, because we indeed find that what incarnates from one life to another is really this character of the person. We develop habit patterns, and that's a different kind of memory. It's a non-local memory. And this non-local nature of this kind of memory has been directly been verified also. Because, for example, if you train a bunch of rats, and this is what is done, what was done by a neurophysiologist named Carl Ashley. He trained rats to find cheese in a Y maze, and then he started chopping off various parts of rat's brain. And then, to his surprise, because at that time the theory was that the memory is localized in the brain, you know, in engrams. Mm-hmm. But even with 50% of the rat's brain chopped off, the rats made their way to the cheese, which means that a character pattern, a pattern that has been learned, is not memorized in the brain. It must be memorized non-locally, not in space and time. And this is what the reincarnational data needs. This is the kind of experiment that verifying the non-local nature of memory. Non-local, the word non-local here means outside of space and time. And if this kind of memory is outside in space and time, we can understand how that can be inherited by somebody in the future.
All right. Let me ask you a question about math now. How does consciousness manipulate math? In other words, do we create our own reality or not?
Yes, we create our own reality. But we should not be confused. We do not create our own reality from our ego, from the ordinary state of our consciousness, but from that non-ordinary state of consciousness that I was talking about a little bit before, where we have real freedom. In other words, from our ordinary ego, we cannot create anything. We don't have the power of creativity. We just are conditioned beings. That's the definition of the ego. We have our choices are conditioned by our past experiences. Our freedom is quite compromised by our past experiences. We call it freedom, but it's not really freedom. It's subject to what we had, what is based on our memory. So real freedom is accessed only when we are in this non-ordinary state of consciousness where you, I, and everybody else are one. This is the one consciousness that spiritual traditions talk about. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. How is our physical surroundings created? Is it created, are we creating 2 years from now, right now, or are we creating right now, right now? Or is something creating 2 years from now, right now? Or are we creating every moment in the moment? Does that make sense?
We are creating moment to moment our experience by collapsing possibilities. And usually, of course, we create the world that is familiar. We create from our conditioned we create with the prejudice of our conditioned being. This is why the word create cannot even be used. We really live and relive and relive the same continuity that we experience usually. So the word create is misleading. This is not creation in any sense. This is just collapsing from the possibilities, the actual events that we are familiar with, that we are conditioned with, repeatedly. So in that sense, we shouldn't use the word create. But in a sense, we do moment to moment transform possibilities into actual events. That we do. So in that sense, there is also some meaning to the word creation.
Okay. Now
it becomes a little confusing.
Can be. I mean, it takes a lot of thought to, make it, but it makes sense. That makes sense. I want to talk for a minute about the fossil gaps. Can you talk about that and the significance of that in creation?
Yes. Now we are going into the subject of creative evolution. I'm glad. So evolution, as Darwin theorized, requires a continuous lineage of fossils. Connecting every organism with any other organism. In other words, every species should have a continuous lineage going into another species like that. Even for macroevolution, there should be a clear lineage from birds to reptiles to birds, and for reptiles to mammalians, mammals to more sophisticated mammals like primates, from primates to human. But this is what we don't have. Instead, macroevolutionary organisms are usually separated by what is called fossil gaps. There are gaps in the fossil lineage. We never have bridged these gaps. And occasionally we do find one or two intermediates, but they are very, very small in number. Their numbers do not justify Darwin's theory, because Darwin's theory literally needs thousands upon thousands of these intermediates, which we have never found. So, therefore, we are theorizing that there is creativity in biological evolution, because creativity is discontinuous. Creativity, we have shown, has quantum leaps, requires quantum leaps, discontinuous jumps. So in the same way, in biological evolution, if they're created by creative quantum leaps, you know, that creativity that we're talking about, that requires a non-ordinary state of consciousness, then we can understand these fossil gaps.
So the creativity, we're talking about big mind there. What do you think accounts for mind suddenly changing its mind?
Well, what happens usually in creativity is that a crisis occurs. When crisis occurs, then small minds give away to big mind, and that's why creativity can't come. If we don't have crisis, then small mind holds on to its conditioned way of existence. And then big mind, out of its benevolence, usually does not interfere, and we go on living in the conditioned way. But when we have a crisis in our life, big suffering, then we can change. So that's why many people are saying that, well, today we are facing many big sufferings like global warming, terrorism, economic meltdown. So maybe we have such a crisis, and maybe big mind will come and rescue us, and we'll have a paradigm shift, a big change in worldview. And, you know, this is symbolized by, in some people's thinking, by the Mayan calendar stuff in 2012, you know, the world will change as we know it, that kind of thing. I think that's a metaphor. It's not necessarily that it will happen in 2012, but it will happen sometime soon. It is very clear that the old science has to be replaced by a new paradigm based on the primacy of consciousness, not primacy of matter, based on God, not atheism, based on creative evolution, not continuous Darwinism. We have to supersede this present-day materialist science because it is grossly incomplete. It is right now unable to solve the problems that it has created, like these problems I was just mentioning, global warming, economic meltdown. So we have to take the cue from the new science and build more complete systems to guide our society. For example, I'm very busy talking about spiritual economics these days. I'm very busy talking about alternative medicine these days.
So,
these are the contributions of new science.
So I know, Amit, that you spend a great deal of time observing, or in the moment, whatever you want to call it, so that you get connected to big mind.
Yeah.
Do you have messages or information specific about what you think is going to happen?
Well,
Time guidelines? I mean, what do you hear?
I think that time has come for all of us consider the possibility that since we all have the privilege of deferring to the big mind for creative experiences, we need many more humans to engage creatively with the problems that we are facing today in order to solve them. In other words, the solutions require the participation of many more people than traditionally have participated in the subtle endeavors such as creativity and energies of love. We need many more people to participate in them. And so it is our prerogative. In fact, this is what will happen if our worldview changes, that many more people will see that it is within their capacity to change. You know, our current president got elected with the slogan that change is imperative. Yes, we can change, but we cannot change without changing our worldview. We cannot change without acknowledging that we have the power of creation only in the non-ordinary state of one consciousness. We do not have that power in our ego. In our ego, what we create is just ordinary, the conditioned. If we want to create new solutions for our huge problems, for our crisis problems, then we have to take quantum leaps, and that requires a change in worldview, a collective engagement with creativity for all of us. And this
has to be acknowledged. Are you getting positive feedback to your socioeconomic model?
I'm getting enormously positive feedback. We just, my associates, Reese Stewart and Renee Slade have just produced a beautiful movie called The Quantum Activist, where we have suggested any of these ideas that we are talking about. Quantum activist is one who has dedicated his or her life using quantum principles to change not only himself or herself, but the entire society. In other words, we are bringing the idea that spiritual traditions have always had, that you cannot change the world, you can only change yourself. We are saying that, well, it is not true that we change the world by changing ourselves, but it is also true that we can also change the world by collectively participating in the changes. So we have started a new movement called quantum activism, of which spiritual economics, developing a new form of economics to replace the very materialist economics of today, which gave us the meltdown. We are hard at work to establish this spiritual economics. We are hard at work to establish an integrative medicine that will integrate conventional and alternative medicine. These are our priorities. But we are also working. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
We are also working towards establishing the meaning of democracy. You know, we have an extremely polarized country. We need to acknowledge that this polarization, exclusivity is not the way. This is not the movement of consciousness. Movement of consciousness is wanting to take us towards unity, not separateness. This has to be understood. We are also working towards creating a situation where the science of spirituality, that's what we have developed, is acknowledged by the world's religions, and we move on to a post-secular age, and educational system itself needs to be revised. So this is a huge amount of plan, but that's what we are doing.
So how are the world religions responding? I'm sorry, I had to come outside. How are the world religions responding to that?
Well, the initial response is good. We are having communication with Jewish Kabbalists. We are having communication with Buddhists. We are having communications with Hindu monks, Tibetan monks. So the initial response is very good. Christians, you know, a Christian group even put up my name, nominated my name for a prize. Surprise, surprise. So, you know, there is good reception, but we have to work hard to get it much more universal. Fortunately, the reception to the movie, The Quantum Activist, has been just enormous. It just got released, and we are getting just tremendous reception to it. So we individually, I have not heard anything yet from Catholic Church, so I don't know. But the reception from the church that we have heard is good.
So what can we do to help you, Amit?
I think what you're doing, Eva, is good, and this interview is good. I think that what we have to do is to just create an awareness that the most pressing emergency is to change the worldview from the primacy of matter to primacy of consciousness. The most pressing emergency is to recognize that spiritual traditions have not been wrong in positing that there is another source of causation than material causation, and spiritual traditions have not been wrong in proposing that there is subtle bodies or the soul that survives the death of the physical body. Those things are just right on, and if we acknowledge them, then we can move on with our evolution, which is towards making better and better representations so that we can use the energies of love. You know, we are running short of energy, the material kind of energy. You know, whether we like it or not, the fact is that we are going to run out of energy if we use it to the extent that we are using it today. So what do we replace it with? The unfortunate thing is that, you know, we don't even really live for this material stuff. What we really want is love. What you really want are those great archetypes, goodness to each other. What you really want is appreciate beauty, appreciate truth. So why not go directly for them? So we need to work more with energies of love rather than physical energies and get, in terms of talking about energy shortage and all these problems that are bothering us today. We cannot spend too much energy because that produces pollution. Obviously, our finite planet is limited. The physical world has limitations. It's a zero-sum game. We have to play that game very carefully. But the subtle domain is infinite. There is no limit of how much you can love. There is no limit of how happy you want to be. Whole is always whole. So, you know, these simple truths that spiritual traditions are teaching us for millennia now is being backed up by solid scientific theory, solid scientific facts, data. We should heed them. We should really accept that there is a new paradigm that is now solidly theorized and solidly verified by experimental data. It's time to say goodbye to materialist thinking. It's time to say goodbye to hedonism. It's time to say goodbye to consumerism. And it's time to change our habits for ourselves and for the world.
And I want to ask you, I'm only going to keep you about 10 more minutes if that's okay, and that'll make an hour, pretty much an hour of consistent talk, if that's all right with you. I want to ask you this as a scientific question, but I don't know how to word it scientifically, so I'm going to ask you in language, just my everyday language. We hear all of the time that I'm just going to use 2012 just because that's a good metaphor for this, but that we're going to shift to a higher frequency, shift to a higher consciousness, whatever you want to call that. So let's assume that if you've watched James Redfield's movie, The Celestine Prophecy, when this shift occurs, what will happen to the people who are of really high, who has actually shifted and enlightened and experienced enlightenment? Does their mind change? Will their physical body speed up and become like transparent somewhat, or will it all stay the same? From a physics perspective, mixed with metaphysics, what do you think about that? What do you think will happen when this thing happens?
These are the Celestine Prophecy or the 2012 talking about the Mayan calendar. These are all metaphors. These are not quite scientific, but they're making a point, good point metaphorically. When we transform, when we change, when we make use of positive emotional energies, like energies of love, then it does feel like a huge transformation that we have a body of light. But that should not be taken physically. Physically, our bodies will remain the same. It's not going to change. Physically, the changes that are prophesied in this book, or these movies, Celestine Prophecies, one, the movie Secret, these are all taken to be metaphors. We cannot take them literally. If we take them literally, we'll only be disappointed. But literally what is going to take place is also already tremendous. If we can change our worldview from the materialism to a consciousness-based worldview, the first thing that happens is that we start valuing the subtle. We start valuing the energies of love more than the physical energies of that comes from fossil fuels, even solar energy, you know, that's still physical energy and limited in its capacity. The energies of love are unlimited. Once we recognize it and start using it properly, I'm not suggesting that we give up all of material level of prosperity and material level of investment, but we should not invest our whole being into that. We should not become consumers because then we become limited. Instead, let's look into the stuff of the subtle, look into the possibilities of the unlimited, and live our life more happily. Let's go directly to happiness, not to the intermediary of consumerism.
Yeah, one more question for you, and then I'll let you go. if I understand it correctly, Fritz Pops did an experiment one time with a seedling. The story I heard was he used a seedling of corn. And then he put it in something like a Faraday cage or something where no other energy could get in. And when he used his equipment, what he could see standing there with this 1-inch seedling of corn or whatever it was an 8-foot stalk of corn in light, and that seedling merely grew into that 1-inch seedling grew into that 8-foot seedling of corn that was in light. I have two questions here. First of all, if you know about that.
I haven't heard of this experiment, but of course, you know, if it's a subtle energy experiment, it sounds like it. Then, you know, it may be possible to understand it by analyzing through the subtle energies. In other words, vitality is something that every living being has associated with it. And we have done very little experiment with that. And if the vital energies are directly explored, not just the physical, then what will seem to be very miraculous in the physical becomes quite understandable from the vital energy point of view. So, you know, when I hear such stuff that sounds miraculous from a physical point of view, I always say that, okay, let's be patient. Let's be patient and see if we change our point of view to that of subtle energies, if we can understand it.
So with that, seems like it would give us indication that we grow into our reality. If that stalk of corn was already there, let's assume that's true, because I heard it that I've seen through some of those people. I don't think those people would misinterpret it, you know, like Jim Oshman and that group. Then that would mean that we're really, the hologram would already be there and consciousness infuses it and brings it to life. Is that right?
In a way.
That makes sense.
But you still have to go into the details. So, I have to look at the actual experiment that was done and look at the various aspects of it and explain how the subtle energy works out for this case. One should not be hasty, in other words. I am not going to give you an affirmative answer this way or that way on the radio without looking at the data myself. But I'll tell you this, that we'll be open to it. We now have many more avenues to explain the behavior of the living and the conscious. Non-living material interactions are very limited. So what seems to be miraculous in the domain of the living and the conscious is miraculous because they are outside the jurisdiction of material interactions. But for the living and the conscious, there is consciousness. There is the subtle energies. There is the mind giving meaning. There is the supramental. So there is a lot of scope for a lot more movement than mere physical interactions allow. And this is a tremendous emancipation that is taking place in science, tremendous new scope of exploration, and I think we'll be better off if we keep our mind open and analyze what new things can happen if we open ourselves to these new domains of reality.
Thank you so much, Annette, tonight. Thank you for your patience with our technical difficulties. I hope it won't inhibit you from coming back on my show again sometime in the future when I can actually have my book back and be prepared for you. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Eva. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, and good night. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.